Lab 10 a.m. show. Thanks for listening.
This is WGTD HD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Guida Brown, former executive director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW-Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, Vice President for Community and Government Relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
Hello, this is Jonathan Shaler on WGTD-FM, and you're listening to Education Matters. It's my great honor to be hosting an interview today with Dr. Lynn Akey, the new chancellor at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Dr. Akey came to us in January from Minnesota State University, Mankato, where she had been working for, was it 10 years, Lynn?
Almost 23 and a half years, actually.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. The 10 years has more to do with your positions working with strategic planning.
Yes.
And institutional effectiveness. You most recently served as the Vice President for Student Success, Analytics, and Integrated Planning at Minnesota State. So wonderful. Welcome. And we are so excited to have you here and to hear what you think about your first semester here at UW-Parkside. For those of us who don't know, I almost laughed to say this because I feel like our listening audience is so centered in southeastern Wisconsin, but UW-Parkside is a student-centered university that serves approximately 4,300 students and offers 51 undergraduate majors, 87 minors and certificates, and 16 graduate degrees across four academic colleges. It is known as the Engaged University and is just a wonderful school. And I learned recently from you, Dr. Akey, that it is the most affordable of the 13 campuses in the system.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful. So anyway, yes. Welcome. And what do you think of this campus and these people after your first several months here?
Yeah, well, thank you so much. First off, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. I so much like the name of your talk, Education Matters. When I saw that, I thought, oh, yes, absolutely. I can't wait for the opportunity to connect with you this morning. As you mentioned, I had a chance to join and start here officially at Parkside January 2nd. So I'm just closing in here on kind of 4 months, my first semester, and what a journey it has been. It's really been a pleasure to get to know the campus more deeply, to get to know the community around us, and just even the region, as well as the universities of Wisconsin. I love how you describe the university there as you're starting out our time together as the engaged university. And I think that is such an excellent descriptor of who we are as a university and really just everything we bring to the experience for our students. I think we just have so much to offer both now and as we're thinking about the future.
Fantastic. And has anything surprised you over these first several months?
Goodness. You know, what surprises me actually is that UW-Parkside is the hidden gem of the universities of Wisconsin or the region. Mm. Because certainly if you know the institution, you know the faculty and staff, the students that we serve, the communities that we serve, my goodness, we absolutely are a gem, but there's no reason for us to be hidden. Mm-hmm. And so that surprises me. That we've been hidden for this long, but it also certainly shines brightly as a clear opportunity for the future.
Fantastic. And you are having tremendous experience, and maybe we could do a little bit of a walkthrough. We talked about this before the interview. I'm very interested in people's life stories and how they move through life through the lens of education, both formal and informal. So could you tell us a little bit about where you grew up and what your interests were, and how you got to, we could go up to undergraduate for our first stage.
All right. Sounds good. Yes. Let's start that conversation. So I consider the upper Midwest to be home. I was born and raised, particularly in my earlier years, in central Illinois, but I've actually lived in all three parts of the state, central, northern, and southern. And in fact, my family roots on both my mother and father's side come from southern Illinois. And that's where a good portion of my family still resides. My mother's family are all dairy farmers. They all still do actively farm in southern Illinois. And my father, they were merchants, and he then went into the military. He's a veteran and used his GI benefits, actually, was how he pursued higher education. So I'm second generation of higher education because of my father's use of his GI benefits to pursue higher education.
Nice.
But I lived primarily in Illinois growing up, and as well as in Indiana for a little while. And really what I'm a product of public education all the way through, from start to finish. I ended up pursuing my undergraduate experience at what is now called Truman State University. When I was there, I was actually the last graduating class from Northeast Missouri State University. So as described at that time, it's in the northeastern region of Missouri. It is Missouri's small public liberal arts institution.
Oh,
so in many ways is somewhat similar to Parkside, in that it served around 6,000 students, and very much had a comprehensive, you know, undergraduate experience. When I went there, though, I actually thought I was going to be a pre-med chemistry major. Wow. And that's how I got my start. But very quickly into my undergraduate experience, realized I enjoyed campus life. I joined a music fraternity. So I was very involved in the arts, particularly in the music area. And so I knew that I wanted much more from my campus life experience in campus life beyond what it would require for me to be successful as a pre-med chemistry major. And so shortly after my first year, I moved my major, like many of our students do, and make those changes. And I became a psychology major. And I started working in the residence halls, which I continued to do for a very long time. And I knew that I wanted to be in a helping profession and working with others. And as I progressed throughout my undergraduate experience, I then discovered that I really liked working with young adults or young people as a population. And I was really drawn towards education, particularly post-secondary education, because I was really passionate about helping as many young people as possible sort of realize their potential for the future. I continued in very involved in student life throughout my undergraduate experience, serving as a community advisor, working in a living learning community, worked very closely with faculty as a part of my undergraduate experience. And so as I wrapped up my degree there at Truman State, I then went directly on to pursue my master's in college student development. And I did that at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. And they have a phenomenal program that actually brings together the educational experience. You're actually in the classroom, but you're also required to hold a full assistantship while you're doing that. And so I lived and worked on the Bowling Green campus the first year of my master's program. And then the second year, I actually had the opportunity to venture a little bit north up to the University of Michigan. And I lived and worked on the Ann Arbor campus. And there I had the opportunity to join the housing division. They were working on a really large project and conceptualizing how they might structure the on-campus housing experience to maximize the development of community. You think about it, the University of Michigan campus is a very large urban-ish campus. And so they were bringing young people to that institution and struggling with how they helped, 18 to 22-year-olds find their place, their sense of community within such a large institution. And so I worked there conceptually With their long range planning, to think about how they organize both their learning experience and housing experience to maximize community and sense of belonging. I had a phenomenal experience there. And as I wrapped up my master's degree at Bowling Green, I then took my next position, which was at Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. Mm-hmm. Again, continued in student life and housing. Again, very focused there. They have a strong living learning component. Again, thinking about how do you bring the classroom learning experience into the out of class experience and create campus community and sense of belonging. Enjoyed my time there immensely before I then had the opportunity to go to Minnesota State University, Mankato. Mm-hmm. And started there in student life as well, but moved out of housing at that time and moved into academic programs. So I worked with the living and learning programs at Mankato, worked with family orientation. I also had the chance to be an academic advisor for about 350 students while I was there. And did that for a number of years before I progressed into student affairs administration. So really working with the various different aspects of student life and absorbing responsibilities around budget and personnel and planning and assessment of student learning. So I spent first 10 years of about 24 years in the student life side before I had the opportunity to move into the office of the provost. And then I spent the next 10 years really focused in the Office of the Provost around curriculum development, around assessment of student learning. And that's where I started to really focus in on institutional research, data analytics, and integrated planning across the institution. I was fortunate then my last 5 years at the institution to serve as the Vice President for Student Success, Analytics, and Integrated Planning.
Fantastic. So over that wonderfully rich career arc and evolution, you could say, what, as you look back, what do you feel that you have carried forward with you? What experiences remain with you as moments of inspiration and foundational?
Sure. Wow. I think there's a lot. Right. When you think back across one's career, the things that inspire and move you, as I mentioned just a moment ago, I think my undergraduate experience was certainly foundational to the ways in which I think about a university, collegiate, post-secondary experience. Yeah, I was fortunate to be able to have the opportunity to learn on a fairly small campus, to have relationships with faculty. And to work with faculty in a day-to-day way. I think that certainly I had the opportunity to experience that sense of belonging, that sense of community that I think it is so important. And so that certainly propelled my thinking as I went on to my master's and thinking about how do you make a large school like Michigan feel small, like Truman State was, right? How do you get those benefits of a small school experience at a large institution? And I think those principles certainly carried forward with me as I went throughout my career, and I think still, carry with me today. And thinking about how do we make our campus a place where all different types of students have a sense of community, have a sense of belonging. I think I also bring with me and across the real appreciation for the connection between the in-classroom learning experience and the out-of-classroom learning experience, and recognizing that, we're helping young people develop skills in all types of ways, again, in the classroom or outside of the classroom, and recognize the real value of that. I think the other piece that I bring with me from my experience is just the real richness of a campus environment that I love. We've got that learning that's happening, but also we have research that's occurring and we're discovering new things. We also have the performing arts, for example. And so that also just enriches our entire life and experience. And so, you really recognize and realize how not only do we have a meaningful contribution to the students that we serve, but also our faculty and staff's lives and the community around us as well. And mm-hmm. so the importance of making that connection mm-hmm. is also something that I think I carry with me.
Fantastic. Could you give us an example, maybe a story of a time, and it could be from this semester at Parkside or from a previous encounter, where a conversation that you have with a faculty member or a student puts a light bulb on and helps you to make a connection that you then bring to a committee meeting, and then that perhaps goes to the budget planning meeting, and then you later see realized in a new initiative or building. I'm trying to help our audience get a little bit of the feeling of actually how an administrator works to make things happen, connecting with people, but then using that to make things happen at the university.
Sure. Well, I think let me go back to one of my very first weeks here on the job. There's, I would say, two experiences that I had that I think come together for me very well and sort of shaping a little bit of my vision and some of the dialogue that I think I've tried to carry forward across the semester. I had the opportunity before classes started in January to connect with the workshop that was happening with a number of faculty involved that were looking at how to bring community-based learning and experiential learning, active learning into the classroom. And they were engaged in a workshop. And it was wonderful to interact with that group of faculty as they were thinking about how they can really fully engage students in learning, either through community-based learning or through experiential learning, active learning techniques that they're bringing to their class. Mm. And the importance of that, right? And the richness of that, not just for the students that they would be serving, but also for the faculty themselves. Many shared, you know, why this was such a powerful way for them to engage professionally. I then had an opportunity also in those early weeks to engage with a group of students from our Office of OMSA, Office of Multicultural Affairs, as well as GSAC, our Gender and Advocacy Center, and speak with them about their experience here at the institution. They were here on campus, again, doing some planning work and preparation for the spring term. Mm. And that group of students talked passionately about their experiences here at Parkside, and for many of them, how Parkside really made it possible to pursue the access that we provide to higher education is phenomenal. Mm. But beyond that access that we provided to those students, the opportunity. So many students will talk about Parkside gave me access. And I knew that when I chose to come to Parkside. What I didn't realize, many students will tell me, is the immense opportunity that it then provided. And what I see for our students is when they recognize the opportunity that they have from the access that has been made available, they just flourish and maximize what that opportunity could mean for them now and in the future. Oh. What I also heard from those students, though, was how important it was to have that sense of belonging, to have that sense of engagement, and to do so in a way that makes a difference, right? That has an impact.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them, those talked about the challenge that they have in being able to balance that learning experience that they want to have with the requirement to work and with the requirement to meet life's demands.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, those interactions early on really brought full force for me the vision of recognizing Parkside as that place that fully supports and should be designed to support that learner that needs to be living fully life, working fully to support the life, and learning fully. Yeah. And a recognition that we have a large number of individuals within our surrounding community that are wanting to do just that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to figure it out. And the important steps we need to take forward as an institution to ensure that we're designed that we're offering experiences, learning opportunities, both in and outside of the classroom that help students do that full life, living, learning, and working all at the same time. And at a level that perhaps other universities across the University of Wisconsin are not designed to do.
Yes.
I think I recognized, as a part of that, you know, really just that Parkside, I think, has the opportunity to be fairly distinctive in the way in which it can do that because of the students that we uniquely serve and the region in which we actually are residing.
Yes. You know, I think many of our listeners are familiar with the fact that I'm a professor of communication at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. We have a master's program in professional communication. And as you were describing the challenges of students working full-time and or many hours and working to get their degrees, I was thinking just the other day in our master's class on dialogue, I'm bringing together groups of students from remote locations online, and we're managing to find times when we can all speak to each other live, virtually. And in those encounters, it's just so poignant for me how students are making it work. For example, one student was there with her grandchild and was managing to multitask as we were going through the dialogue. Another student was at her place of work. She was working at a fast food restaurant, and we could see she was in uniform. She was in a booth. We could see the traffic behind her. The place was open and active, but somehow she had arranged it so that the sound was working. There were no distractions, and she made it happen. So it's amazing the resilience and the resourcefulness of our students. And you're right. We help to make that happen. This is the character of this university. So thank you. So I wanted to perhaps bridge to a couple of controversies that, or that might be a strong word, but think challenges, I suppose, that are on the horizon for a lot of universities and have a particular twist for UW-Parkside. So one that's been in the news a lot recently has been the budget issues in Wisconsin, and how, I think you can correct me if I'm wrong, about $32 million was frozen or withheld from the UW system budget by the legislature on the grounds that they wanted a reorientation from what they saw as a heavy emphasis on diversity, equity, and inclusion investment to more of a focus on workforce development. And the fallout has been, well, you tell us, where are we now with all of that at UW-Parkside?
Yeah, you know, that is an interesting conversation that, you know, progressed throughout, I think, the fall, really, even before my arrival. And yes, certainly, I think, you know, leadership from the Universities of Wisconsin and our legislature worked together to come to an agreement on how to move forward to be able to release the $32 million that were being withheld for workforce investment for us here at Parkside. That's right around $1 million on an annual basis for us to be able to invest in areas to bring more students credentials that align with what our workforce needs. Mm-hmm. You know, as a part of that agreement, though, there was a condition that we at the system would review the number of positions that we have dedicated to supporting diversity, equity, and inclusion direct efforts, as well as the number of positions we have that just serve in administrative capacity across the system. You know, in that regard, for us here at Parkside, the impact, you know, is really not a direct impact in that, you know, we are already structured in a way that our services are directed to support all students being successful and belonging here at the institution. So the number of positions that we had that, you know, the system had agreed would reduce in totality overall, it is really not a direct impact for us.
That's wonderful. And if I could just interrupt for a moment,
I need
to give a station ID. So this is WGTD Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Shaler. This is Education Matters. And we're speaking with Dr. Lynn Agee, the new chancellor at UW Parkside. Right now, we've been discussing budget challenges and how Parkside has been really well positioned to meet those challenges because of our commitment to student success. So, Lynn, I'm sorry that I cut you off there for a moment, but did you want to say anything more about that?
I was just going to say that, you know, what I feel so fortunate about here at Parkside is that our student body, which is the most diverse, domestically diverse student body within the universities of Wisconsin, we've been long on this journey of ensuring that we're supporting student success, that we're focused on what it takes to ensure all students have an opportunity to find community, to have a sense of belonging. So for us, it's really continuing down the pathway that we are already on.
Yeah.
I think the other piece of that, though, is that the $32 million means that we do have the ability to provide and some seed funding to start some new areas of focus or expand. So, you know, as the institution recently had its master's program in physician assistant supported by accreditors, so that gives us the opportunity to progress in an area that's a high workforce need, particularly within the health professions across the state and certainly also within our region, as well as looking at further investments in how we support business technology. Artificial intelligence certainly is, you know, recognize that as a large area of workforce growth as well. So it's nice to have those resources.
Artificial intelligence. What are your thoughts about it? As you know, that it's caused some concern among faculty and instructors that students may not be doing as much of their own writing anymore. But there's obviously great excitement and opportunity with that amazing technology. So do you have a take on this?
Well, I'm certainly listening and learning, I think, with everyone, right? This whole topic of AI and how it's going to impact our world. What we know is it's going to have a dramatic impact, and it's happening fast, right? And certainly from the higher education lens, thinking about how does that change the landscape of, you know, living, learning, and work. But certainly in the learning environment space, what we know is it's here, right? And it is absolutely a part of the learning experience. Certainly it's a challenge and recognized for our faculty to think about how do we recognize it and in some ways integrate it into the curriculum, because trying to pretend it doesn't exist is not going to work, because it does,
right?
And so how do we bring it into the learning sphere? You know, I think for us as an institution, this is where I lean on the fact that we have a strong liberal arts general education foundation. And that's where, you know, we have something to bring to the table and ensuring that our students know how to engage with AI in a way that has integrity, that upholds one's ethics, that helps one think critically, because that's what's going to be needed as we work in an additional AI world. Whether our, you know, graduates, future workforce members are thinking about how AI can help streamline or improve the work environment or the capacity or the efficiency to get something done, or is thinking about AI when they're the receiver of information to be able to think critically about, does this perhaps AI generated content make sense? You know, AI, at least at this point in time, doesn't necessarily have the full ability to make appropriate decisions within a human-based context.
Right.
And so I think that that is the skill set, the foundational skills that we as an institution are well prepared to provide students. And so I think, again, it's a learning challenge. It's a curricular challenge for our faculty, certainly, to take on a huge disruption within our world. But I think it also leads the way to pointing out how critical the foundational skills that we give students are now and certainly into the future.
What other challenges and opportunities do you see in the near future?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the challenges that I'm really thinking hard about right now is how we further partner with the business, the corporations, the industry that is within our region, particularly as we're thinking about the students that we're called to serve. Going back to our earlier conversation, as we're recognizing that our students are needing to fully live, learn, and work in a cohesive way, how do we ensure the educational offerings that we provide support that? And what opportunities might we have to be innovative in that space, in particular to partner with businesses, with industries, with corporations, to ensure that they have the educated workforce that they need both now and into the future. I'm certainly concerned about the number of young people that we have in our region that are choosing not to pursue higher education, either right after high school or at all. I'm also worried and concerned about the number of young people in our community that perhaps through the pandemic chose not to pursue higher education to go straight into the workforce. And now they're 3, 4, or 5 years in, and they've not had the opportunity to engage in post-secondary education. And what does that mean? You know, while I certainly understand and appreciate the appeal of going straight into the workforce, we're fortunate in this region to have strong economy, to have strong investment, that we have employers that are looking for and wanting to source a workforce. And I can imagine, certainly as a young person who's maybe 18 or 20, to have a starting wage of $20 to $25 an hour, that's compelling. But I also then have to balance that with the perspective of thinking about what our economy and workforce will need 15 years from now. They're going to need workers that are educated. And so if our young people are choosing to go straight into the workforce and not investing in education, where will that leave us? And so I do think we have a fundamental challenge in front of us to think about how do we partner so that our young people see that choosing and engaging and investing in higher education is something they can do along with pursuing a workplace career.
There's something to be said for a liberal arts education. Where would it leave students if they bypassed the opportunity? What do you see as the special value of a liberal arts education?
Sure. Well, I agree with you absolutely that what we provide is that opportunity to develop those foundational critical skills that help an individual not only move into the workforce, start down a career path, but also prepares a young person to engage in the multiple careers they might have over a lifetime or jobs within a career track over a lifetime. So certainly for me, that cornerstone of, critical thinking is so important. The ability to communicate both in writing and orally, those interpersonal skills, right, to be able to collaborate, to work in teams, the ability to be innovative and problem solvers within our society certainly knows we have plenty of problems to solve that we will need our young people to help us with. So those are some of those foundational skills that I think our liberal arts foundation, general education core help to provide and that are so critical beyond the technical skills that one might need to enter the workforce, but in order to pursue a career.
Yes. I always tell people that when you look at what Fortune 500 companies, for example, say is most important, their list of skills that they're looking for entry-level employees, it's always over and above specific training in a niche performance area. They are looking for the skills that you just described, critical thinking, communication, teamwork, problem solving. And that's what a liberal arts education gives you. So that's music to my ears. Speaking of music, tell us more about your connection to music. We're going back now to Lynn Akey in the music fraternity.
I picked up the clarinet when I was in sixth grade. So that's how I got started into music. That was only a year after piano, because I had to demonstrate to my parents that I could be committed to practice. So I had to do a year of piano before I earned my clarinet. Mm-hmm. And so I was a clarinetist all through junior high school, the march bands, you know, concert bands. And then went to Truman State. And so there, I was not a music major. As I mentioned, I was a pre-med chemistry major, but music was definitely a large part of my life. And so I was a part of the marching band there, and did join the music fraternity, Sigma Alpha Iota, while I was there as well. And so did that all 4 years. I did not march all 4 years, I should say. I you know, actively marched my freshman and sophomore year. But then after that, set my marching aside because of my classwork. Courses don't always go. But most of my close friends were music majors, either performance or teaching education. And so, you know, progressed through that. I played a little bit just in community organizations after, you know, I finished my bachelor's while I was working on my master's. You know, now I guess I should say, you know, while I was a clarinetist, so woodwind, I did have the opportunity while I was marching to actually switch over. I played the mellophone for a little while as well. And so not afraid to pick up a new instrument.
Wow. That's seems to be a metaphor for something. Yeah. You know what, Lynn, I played the clarinet starting in fourth grade, and in college I was in the marching band as a clarinetist. So we have something in common. You switched to mellophone at one point. I wonder if it had anything to do with the fact, something that was haunting me a bit was that clarinet and marching band, clarinet didn't seem to be the strongest position in a marching band. I mean, every instrument is important, but, you know, mellophone, you're putting a little more out there, I think, on the field.
Yes.
For me, it was a transition to announcer for the marching band. So I ended up in the booth telling people to stand for the national anthem and that sort of thing. But the mellophone, I haven't heard about that one in a long time. Does that instrument still exist?
Oh, yeah, it's the marching French horn, right?
Yeah.
So, yes, yeah. And you are correct. You know, as a clarinetist, woodwinds, when it comes to marching, you end up sort of in that support back of the field role. And, you know, as we were working on our sophomore year show, there was a heavy brass influence. And so there was a whole section of us, about six of us, who said, all right, let's give that a go. And so we set our clarinets, woodwinds aside, and picked up the mellophone. The summer between my freshman and sophomore year, we all kind of self-taught, learned, practiced, so that we were ready for the next marching season.
Ah, fantastic. So while we're in this thread, this is my favorite part of the interview, more about Lynn Akey, the human being. And I know that you have a couple of dogs. Could you tell us about them?
I do. Grew up with dogs. I'm a huge animal person in general, of all different types. In fact, I was just meeting with the biology department the other week, and I was telling them that I was as a young person, I volunteered at the local zoo, and I was the display person for the python. And so, so I'm waiting to meet Vivian here on campus. I hope sometime soon, as our own local python. But I have two dogs right now, Captain and Coda. They're fairly young. They're both just a little over 2 years old now. Captain is a golden doodle. So he's just a complete sweetheart teddy bear. And then my youngest is sort of a special little project for me. He's a German short-haired pointer.
Oh.
A very different personality than a golden doodle. German short-haired pointers have kind of this quirky little, very prey-driven passion, but then they're also very sensitive sweethearts as well. You might recognize, if you're not familiar with German short-haired pointers, if you go to a lot of the airports, for example, they are the bomb-sniffing dogs. Oh. So they are work-driven dogs, if you will.
Okay.
Bird hunters by nature. but you will see them deployed widely in the field, actively in that space. They're, you know, great canine dogs to serve community. And so, yeah, they have great prey-driven, sense-driven. And so I've done some nose work with him, and I, you know, I have a passion for potentially in the future doing some work around search and rescue. And so German short-haired pointers is a breed that would serve in that capacity. And so I'm trying to hone my skills potentially in that space for the future.
Really? Could you go over that again? Because I didn't quite take that in.
Yeah.
What kind of training?
Mm-hmm. So nose work. So German short-haired pointers are one of those breeds that does very well around nose work. So you can train them to find scents. And so you'll see them again right now. They're often deployed in public spaces, large events, airports, et cetera. So they're drug sniffing dogs, bomb sniffing dogs, again, any sort of type of item. So they also are heavily used in doing like search and rescue missions.
Wow.
Right.
So what do you envision yourself possibly doing in that area?
Yeah, I have an interest. I had the opportunity when I was in Minnesota to actually serve on Minnesota's Southwest chapter of American Red Cross. Mm. And so started to learn quite a bit about opportunities for mission deployment, right, to areas where there might be natural disasters and relief efforts that are underway. And so one of my future interests on the side is to potentially be deployed.
Wow.
To be able to do that. So, 15 years or so in the future here, and would love to be able to, you know, contribute time in doing kind of search and rescue crisis work. Wow. And since I love, you know, dogs and time with my, you know, my dog, that's sort of picking up that as a hobby. And so learning how to train and doing nose work, search and rescue work.
Fantastic. Are you kind of rehearsing that with Captain?
Yeah. Captain, I don't think he's not prey-driven at all. He's a
attention. Oh, I mixed up their names.
Yeah, Coda.
What?
Yeah,
who is
Coda.
It?
Yeah, Coda is my German short-haired pointer.
Okay.
And so, yes. And so I've done just a little bit of nose work with him, doing retrieval work. He's still young, but very energetic. Yeah. But he's also very focused. And so he's been an excellent student thus far.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, that's fantastic. Here's one, and we just have a very short period of time, so I'll keep an eye on the clock. But media consumption, films, books, I don't know, journals. What do you consume? What do you like to look at?
Yeah. Well, you know, I take in just about anything and everything. So I love it all, whether it's music or media or literature. But I will tell you, I love musicals because of the music, right? I love live music because I just, you know, that brings me right back to my collegiate and youthful days. As far as like TV, I really do like kind of real life documentaries and such. Mm. And I think coming from my psychology roots, really love right now I get taken with, if you've seen, you know, Last of the Alaskans or Port Protection, or again, individuals who choose to live in really alternate environments.
Uh-huh.
And I'm really fascinated with their life stories. As well as the choices that they make to live in such remote and in some cases dangerous and rough terrain, as well as sort of those life skills that they bring to bear for survival, right? I guess that probably links a little bit to my earlier hobby of interest, right, in doing crisis and rescue management and stuff. But I'm really fascinated by, you know, kind of the life stories of people and the journeys that they choose for their lives, right?
Wonderful.
And watching that play out. And so documentaries that sort of bring that to life, I find really fascinating.
Well, that's fantastic. And what a great note to end on. I'm so sorry we're out of time.
Yes.
This has been a wonderful interview. Thank you, Lynn Akey.
Yes. Well, Chancellor. Thank you so much. Yes, I appreciate it. Happy to join you again anytime.
Okay. Thank you. This has been WGTD's Education Matters. Jonathan Schiller interviewing Dr. Lynn Akey, the new chancellor at UW Parkside.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at WGTD.org.
I'm Gregory Berg, and I hope that you can join me for Monday's morning show here on WGTD. We're going to be talking about the mighty Mississippi River and its surprisingly complicated history. My guest, Boyce Upholt, has just written a brand new and fascinating book called The Great River, The Making and Unmaking of the Mississippi. Join me, please.